For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Priscilla Huff. All of the nursing homes in Hollywood, Florida are now under inspection after six senior citizens died due to a lack of air conditioning as the power remains out for much of Florida. Currently, officials with the local utilities believe it will take about 10 more days to restore power across the entire state, with about 110,000 people still in shelters following Hurricane Irma. Hollywood, Florida Police Chief Tomas Sanchez confirmed the tragedy.
Right now, we have five confirmed deaths at this facility. We've evacuated 115 patients to other memorial facilities. At this time, we have other patients in critical care. Right now, the building has been sealed off and we're conducting a criminal investigation inside. We believe at this time that may be related to the loss of power and the storm, but we're conducting a criminal investigation, not ruling anything out. At this time, it's a sad event.
Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi will no longer be attending the upcoming United Nations General Assembly. Violence in the country has prompted nearly 400,000 Rohingya Muslims to flee to neighboring Bangladesh, and critics have called for her Nobel Peace Prize to be revoked. From the UN headquarters in New York, our correspondent Will Denslow reports.
In her first address to the United Nations General Assembly last year, Aung San Suu Kyi defended the government's treatment of Rohingya Muslims. But after an escalation of violence in the country over recent weeks, the UN's human rights chief Zayed Raad Al Hussein warned the situation was a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Myanmar's military still holds significant political power in the country. But aid groups want to see Aung San Suu Kyi do more to resolve the crisis. Suu Kyi's spokesperson says she cancelled her trip to this year's UN General Assembly because she's concentrating on establishing stability in Myanmar. She's now expected to give a national address on the subject of peace and reconciliation next week. William Denslow, New York.
Thousands of people have been evacuated from shopping centers and railway stations in Moscow following warnings that they had been rigged with explosives. From the Russian capital city, Julia Lubova reports.
Dozens of shopping centers, railway stations and public buildings have been evacuated in Moscow. However, so far all of the alerts turned out to be hoaxes and the public has been urged to remain calm. The source of the threats remains unclear. According to reports, the alerts appear to have come in the form of a pre-recorded voice message via internet telephony. The evacuations began in the city of Omsk on Sunday. RIA News reported that the hoaxes have so far affected more than 20 Russian towns and cities. Julia Lubova, Moscow.
There is a window of opportunity to reform the European Union and make it stronger. That was the message of EC President Jean-Claude Juncker to the European Parliament. This is FSN.
Thanks very much, Priscilla. Thank you. It's exactly 3 minutes past the hour. This is Wednesday. Is it the 13th? Never easy for me to say, of September 2017. I think I've got an interesting and varied program for you this Wednesday. Twitter, well, it's always open, but I'm watching it now. I'm monitoring Twitter. So if you want to tweet me, do so. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Really looking forward to this program.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. It's the Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
Now, the Institute of the Institute for Jewish Policy Research has released a study, a survey, that claims more than a quarter of British people hold at least one anti-Semitic view. The Institute for Jewish Policy Research said the finding came from the largest and most detailed survey of attitudes towards Jews and Israel ever conducted in Britain. I'll be joined this hour by Deborah Maccabee. Deborah is an executive committee member with Jews for Justice for Palestinians. She doesn't believe the findings of the study. She has a lot of interesting things to say. She joins me this hour. And in the second hour, you'll remember Sandra Fecht first came on this programme 2 years ago, the Canadian family therapist and counsellor. We spoke with her at that time about the fact that patients were telling her stories of ritual satanic abuse. Now, she's in the UK and Ireland for a series of workshops, but I've also learned that the regulatory body for counsellors and therapists in Canada are on her case. That's very serious. We'll talk to Sandra, who's in Dublin today, in the second hour of the programme, and there's a lot of interest in that as well. I look forward to doing that. We're live on davidicke.com. Of course, do bookmark davidicke.com/headlines. Pretty much everything spoken about on this programme also covered in great detail on davidicke.com. richieallen.co.uk. And we're delighted, as always, to be broadcasting live on fabradiointernational.com in Manchester. Hope you've had a good old Wednesday. Hope you're in good form. And as usual, thank you very much for choosing the programme. Big shout out to my friend Stephen Lash, who's a Mancunian and a friend of the programme's. Stephen is listening to the programme in Cordoba in Andalusia, which I know very well, of course, having spent many years in Andalusia. Not based in Cordoba, of course, but based on the Costa del Sol. Stephen, hope you're well, and thanks very much for sending that tweet. Delighted to hear from you. Right, so let's crack on with a bit of news. Not too much news. A couple of things I want to tell you about. Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, has said the UK will soon regret leaving the EU. He told the European Parliament that Brexit would be a sad, tragic moment for the European Union, but that the 27-member union would move on. He said Brexit isn't the future of Europe. It is not the be-all and the end-all, he said. You want to hear what he said? I won't subject you to a lot of it, just a little bit of it. This is Jean-Claude Juncker today, courtesy of the BBC.
March 29th, 2019, that will be the date where the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. This will be a very sad and tragic moment in our history. We will always regret this, but, and I think that you will regret it as well soon, if I might say. Nonetheless, we have to respect the will of the British people. But we are going to make progress. We will keep moving. We will move on. Because Brexit isn't everything. It's not the future of Europe. It's not the be-all and end-all.
Now, in the same debate, the former leader of UKIP, Nigel Farage, said that the European Union had learned nothing from Brexit and was ploughing full steam ahead with its agenda, which we've, I suppose, covered so much on this programme. There's no point in me labouring the fact. By 2025, Juncker wants complete fiscal, economic and political union in Europe. He wants a super state, one country, effectively. You know, basically absorbing every sovereign state in the or on the continent. That's what he wants. And it's interesting he said there about respecting the will of the people, as we spoke about last night in last night's opening salvo. The evidence is they have no intention of respecting the will of the people at all, because their own rules are being broken, the rules that there must be a deal at the end of 2 years. If there isn't, the UK would revert to World Trade Organization trading conditions. But they've broken that rule, of course, and they've already begun to implement this transition period, which I mentioned on the programme yesterday. People like Alistair Darling and all the other Remainers are now pushing to be as long as 5, even 10 years long, if necessary, which, of course, would mean the UK would never leave the EU at all. More on that, of course, in future programmes. Now, George Hook is an Irish radio presenter who's also known for being a rugby union pundit. Very outspoken. He's been described as a shock jock. I wouldn't use the term shock jock myself. He's been around a long time, has George. He's a bit like Marmite. But then again, everybody who makes radio, presents radio, is Marmite, I suppose. You either love or like what they do, or you don't like it. So last Friday, I was away completing my break. Hook broadcast his show on Ireland's News Talk radio station, National Station, as always. It's a daily programme. And something he said in that show got him into a little bit of trouble. He was reporting on the story of a 19-year-old woman who alleges that she was raped by a former member of the British Olympic swimming team. This is in court at the moment. Okay? George Hook, the presenter, posed an open question concerning the possibility that sometimes women might put themselves in harm's way. Now, I'll play you the segment in a second. Since the broadcast, the progressive Twitterati, as we've dubbed them, the Irish media, other broadcasters have called for Hook to be fired. And incredibly, I learned this morning that a letter signed by 20 of his colleagues at News Talk, 20 of his fellow workmates, signed a letter and handed it to the station's manager, calling for him to be fired, saying that misogyny was unacceptable. Yes, his teammates, his workmates have asked for him to be sacked, right? So do you want to hear what he actually said? Remember, he was commenting on the story of the 19-year-old woman who alleges she was raped by a former member of the British Olympic swimming team. This has been hysterical over the last few days, so he must have said something truly heinous, you would have thought. Well, make up your own mind. This is what Hook had to say.
Another story today was a girl who was raped in the United Kingdom by a member of a former member of the British Olympic swim team. Now, she was passed around, went the story, and apparently she went to bed with one guy, and then he goes out, another guy comes in. She doesn't want to have relations with the second guy, but he forces himself upon her. Awful. But when you then look deeper into the story, you have to ask certain questions. Why does a girl who just meets a fella in a bar go back to a hotel room? She's only just barely met him. She has no idea of his health conditions. She has no idea who he is. She has no idea of what dangers he might pose. But modern-day social activity means that she goes back with him, then is surprised when somebody else comes into the room and rapes her. Should she be raped? Of course she shouldn't. Is she entitled to say no? Absolutely. Is the guy who came in a scumbag? Certainly. Should he go to jail? Of course. All those things. But is there no blame now to the person who puts themselves in danger? You then, of course, read that she passed out in the toilet, and when she woke up, the guy was trying to rape her. There is personal responsibility, because it's your daughter and it's my daughter. And what determines the daughter who goes out, gets drunk, passes out, and is with strangers in a room, and the daughter that goes out, stays halfway sober, and comes home? I don't know. I wish I knew. I wish I knew what the secret of parenting is. But there is a point of responsibility.
Yeah, so what do you think of that? Tweet at Richie Allen Show. The upshot of that is Hook has been lambasted from pillar to post in the Republic of Ireland by every feminist group in the country, by every women's rights group in the country, by various people who run women's shelters in the country, by every journalist in the country, by every vox pop. And a vox pop, by the way, is when you take a microphone onto the streets and you ask people what do they think. Everybody thinks that Hook is a misogynist. He's a victim blamer, apparently. He hates women. And he's blaming the victim, apparently. And he has to be fired. Incredibly, 20 of his own colleagues, I have to make this point again, I said it a minute ago, went to the management of the station and said they wanted him out. He hates women. He's blaming the victim. Is he? Is he? Why are women so outraged by it? Are women outraged, or is the progressive Twitterati driving a false narrative, whipping up a storm when there isn't really one there? Doesn't he pose a fair question? Why get rat arse pissed out of your brains and wake up in a strange room? You're not asking for it. He said this clearly. You don't deserve this. He said this clearly as well. And the bastard who did it should be charged and locked up if found guilty. He said this as well. He clearly said nobody is asking for it. Nobody deserves that to happen to them. But the question he did pose is, why put yourself at risk? Why can't you go out and drink moderately? Be a bit more aware of where you are and who you're with. Is that victim blaming? Why can't he say that? I'm 42 years old. I don't have any children. Please God, we will have children someday. I can imagine, and if you're a parent, you feel free to jump on me and say, Richie, you're out of order. I can imagine when the girl heals, and maybe you don't ever heal, maybe you don't ever heal after a sexual assault, but when she gets her life back in order, I can imagine her father, if he's alive, hopefully he's alive, she's only 19, he's probably alive, I can imagine her father having a word with her and saying, why would you do that? Why would you do that? Why, not to blame you for what happened, but why would you get so catatonic that you are unable to protect yourself from the scumbag who took you back to the hotel and fed you, literally fed you to his mates? Is that victim blaming? I wouldn't have thought so. I wouldn't have thought so. It's a media created hysteria. So I was wondering, I was thinking, I wonder if there's something more to this. I wonder if old George, 76-year-old George, has any enemies. Who might want to see the back of George Hook? So I did a bit of digging, and 10 days before George did the rape story, he covered the HPV Gardasil vaccine injured girl's story. He did. And he said this.
The HSE, this huge organisation of thousands of employees with budgets running into millions and billions, are being apparently defeated by a bunch of Irish mothers, so the vaccine has dropped. Am I happy that the vaccine take-up has dropped? No, I am not. But then I hear the failed chief executive of the failed HSE, Tony O'Brien, on the radio describe these mothers as emotional terrorists. How dare he? How absolutely dare he call mothers who care for their children, who watch them in agony and pain, how dare he call them terrorists? If we had a Minister of Health in Simon Harris who wasn't in political nappies and in a job way above his talents, if he had a shred of courage, which the great party Fine Gael seemed singularly lacking in, O'Brien wouldn't have a job today. O'Brien would be sacked. He'd be taking his belongings home in a cardboard box for calling mothers of Ireland emotional terrorists.
There you go. There you go. So he's basically taken on the pharmaceutical companies, the pharmaceutical lobby, the head of the HSC, O'Brien, whom he mentioned and whom was mentioned last night by the amazing Anna Cannon. And while he said there that, you know, he doesn't, you know, have anti-vaccine opinions, he said that it is an outrage that mothers of young girls who are grievously ill, grievously damaged, are being called emotional terrorists by a man. He recommended that man be fired. And he practically demanded that the government either force him to resign or to fire him. These pharmaceutical companies, by the way, spend massive money with Irish newspapers and Irish media, including the commercial radio station News Talk, which he works for. I wonder. I wonder. Because I've been around a long time and I've worked in places. And I've worked with people who, you know, radio stations and television companies are full of egos. We all have egos. I have an ego. Maybe people who make radio programs have more inflated egos than the average man or woman. Maybe we do. Maybe you need to have a bit of an opinion of yourself to do what it is that you do on a daily basis. I can't believe the 20 people in his own company wanted him fired for what he said about the young woman currently going through the court case about the rape, where he basically said, we need to take care of ourselves a bit more maybe when we go out. So he took on the HSC, took on the Irish government, took on pharma, and I'm willing to bet, and I have no proof of this whatsoever, that heads got together after the anti-HSE rant about the vaccines. Heads got together and said, the first opportunity we get to get rid of that bastard, we take it. And on the Friday, George does the rant about, it wasn't even a rant, let's take care of ourselves. When do we take some personal responsibility? There's a massive media hysteria about this, which has gone on from Friday to today. Today is Wednesday. It hasn't left the pages of the Irish newspapers or Irish radio stations. Everybody and their grandmother is demanding that Hook be fired and never be on the airwaves again. 10 days after he said it is unacceptable that Irish women are called emotional terrorists for challenging Gardasil. Now, if Gardasil is allowed to be challenged, if these women are allowed to have their day in court, if they get an inquiry, this will have devastating consequences for those who pushed the vaccine, those who administered the vaccine, and of course the companies that sell it. You're going to tell me that there's no relationship between those two stories? Yeah, I don't think so. It's 21 minutes past the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live in association with DavidIke.com. We're live on Fab Radio 2 as well, and richieallen.co.uk. Going to take a very quick break. Deborah Maccabee joins the programme in a few minutes' time. I'm looking forward to you meeting her back in a minute.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalise, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete. The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imaginings may be the long-awaited answer, designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Sign up today. Email Sue on nassusproductions@gmail.com.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
The FDA imprisoned Dr. Wilhelm Reich for his work with orgone energy in the 1950s. They knew he was onto something. At Vibration, our mission is to help raise the planet's vibrational frequency by getting our orgone to as many people as possible. We're offering a free orgone pendant embossed with the Flower of Life. We just ask a small global shipping and handling fee. To find out more and claim your free pendant, just go to vibration.com/Richie. That's VBRATION.com/Richie. Thank you.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com.
Welcome back. A couple of tweets on George Hook. Kim Lyons. Kim, thanks for sharing this, by the way. Kim said, Richie, I raised the daughter who comes home sober because I was the one who got drunk with the wrong people. Learned my lesson, says Kim. Sorry to hear that, Kim. Thanks for sharing that with us. Shona Dryden tweets, he does pose a good question. Knowing that there are scumbags out there, ladies have to look after themselves, so don't get pissed drunk. Susan says he's a fuckwit. It sounds very much like this young woman was spiked and all other actions via mails appear to be premeditated. That's another good point, Susan. It isn't beyond the bounds of possibility that Rohypnol or one of these other date rape drugs was slipped to the young woman in question. I'm not sure that is the case. I don't think it is actually, but you're right, it is possible as well. Dean says, the flip side is I'm 42, been hammered on loads of occasions, never had I had a bunch of women waiting to rape me, says Dean. You've got to keep a sense of humour and a sense of perspective about these things, I suppose. Right. This is Snow Patrol on the Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com. It's Wednesday, September 13th, 2017. My name is Richie Allen. Thanks for choosing the programme. Hope you're well. Got a couple of great guests. Sandra Fecht joins us live from Dublin in the second hour. But coming up in a minute, it's Deborah McAbee. While we get to Deborah on the line, this is Snow Patrol and a song called Chocolate. Welcome to the programme. That is Snow Patrol. Welcome back to the programme. It's exactly 26 minutes past the hour. Let's welcome our first guest to the show. As I mentioned at the very top of the programme, the Institute for Jewish Policy Research has released a survey claiming that more than a quarter of British people hold at least one anti-Semitic view. This was a study of attitudes towards Jewish people and towards Israel. They say it's the largest and most detailed survey of attitudes towards Jews and Israel ever conducted in Britain. There's a lot to this. So we're joined on the line today from Leeds by the by an executive committee member of Jews for Justice for Palestinians, which is an organisation with over 2,000 members, Jewish men and women in Britain, who campaign for lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians, believing that this requires justice, mutual recognition and respect. It believes, does Jews for Justice for Palestinians, that Israel's discrimination against its Palestinian citizens is unacceptable and that it is crucial that Jews speak out for Palestinians' human rights. Delighted to be joined on the line, as I said, from Leeds by Deborah McAbee. Deborah, thanks so much for taking the call. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
What are your initial thoughts then when you see the publication of that survey, Deborah? What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's very different from a recent survey that was published by the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, which made out that, I think I've got the figure, yes, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism report, which also got a lot of publicity, said that over 80% of British Jews believe Labour is tolerant of anti-Semitism, too tolerant of anti-Semitism within its ranks. 65% think the government doesn't do enough to protect British Jews, while 52% said the Crown Prosecution Service could do more. But it did admit that levels of anti-Semitism were going down. But it was quite... Yes, and it also said that one-third of Jews have considered leaving the country because of anti-Semitism. It was a very confused thing, saying that the majority of Jewish people, of British people, their levels of anti-Semitism are going down, but the Labour Party is a great problem as regards anti-Semitism, and the police are a problem. He said the police were betraying the British Jewish community, and the Crown Prosecution Service was a problem. And so one third of Jews were considering leaving. And this was very sensational. But this report, which is done in a very meticulous way, in a professional way, they've got a new method, which they call the elastic view, which I'll maybe explain a bit more later. This report, I think, shows up how sensational and how wrong that report was. Because I know you said, it said that 30% hold at least one anti-Semitic view. But against that, we have to say that 70% of the, about 70% of the population of Great Britain, to quote from the executive summary, have a favourable opinion of Jews and do not entertain any anti-Semitic ideas or views at all. Only 2.4% are definitely anti-Semitic. And then they say this 30% who hold at least one, they say they can't be called anti-Semitic. We have to have a very elastic view of them, which is that they people can't be actually called anti-Semitic, but they may hold a view which they don't think is anti-Semitic, but which Jews may find offensive. The BBC report actually includes two examples. And I am not sure they are anti-Semitic, actually. One of them was, Jews think they are better than other people. Well, I'm not sure that is so wrong, actually. Not really brought up in a Jewish background. We do have a high opinion of ourselves.
Right.
You know, and I don't think it's so bad to have a high opinion of yourself, really.
You can imagine a Jewish person being annoyed by the stereotype, though, you know. I agree, I don't believe it's anti-Semitic or racist, but you can imagine a Jewish person saying, oh, Jesus, here we go again, you know, another generalisation about the Jews.
Yes, well, yes, I suppose. There are, you know, apparently there are people who would think, of the 30%, some of them think that's true. But I would not think that's terribly anti-Semitic to think that's true. And then there's this one, Jews exploit Holocaust victimhood for their own purposes. Now, you can't say that's a stereotype of all Jews, but there are some Jews who do that. And Norman Finkelstein, who's been on this programme many times, he wrote a whole book about that, the Holocaust industry.
Absolutely right. Now, again, you're right, it doesn't stereotype Jews, but if you were to say, if you were to be at a gathering, I don't know, a concert or something, and you've got people from all backgrounds and faiths, and you made that statement, Jews exploit the Holocaust, there might be Jews in the audience who say, what do you mean, me? I don't exploit the Holocaust. I go about my daily business. I work, I raise a family. I don't exploit the Holocaust. Do those people who talk about Holocaust exploitation need to be a bit more specific when they speak about that?
Well, yes, I think they do have to say that there are some Jews who do it, certainly not that all Jews. But I do think also the Jews who do it, the ones who have been exposed by Norman Finkelstein, they need to think of the effect of their actions upon Jews in general, how they reflect on Jews in general. And I think Israel, calling itself the Jewish state, needs to think about the effect of its atrocities, which inevitably reflect upon Jews in general.
I want to talk to you in a second about the campaign against anti-Semitism, because I know you know a lot about them, and I'm very interested in them. They've been invited on this programme on several occasions. They've been promised the utmost courtesy. I've invited them to come on and, you know, talk about what it is they claim to be anti-Semitic and to kind of thrash out the claims they make, but they haven't. I want to talk about them. But before we do that, Deborah, there are 2,000 Jewish men and women who are members of your organisation, and I must give the website, by the way, it's jfjfp.com, jfjfp.com, that's Jews for Justice for Palestinians. Deborah, what sort of experiences, you're a Jewish lady yourself, what sort of experiences do your friends, do your associates, what are your experiences of anti-Semitism? Do you experience it? Do Jewish people whom you know, do they come across hatred? Is it a regular thing? Tell us about that.
That is certainly, I certainly have not experienced anti-Semitism. The only anti-Semitic incident I can think of at all is when I was caring for my mother, who was 88 and just come out of hospital, and it turned out that she'd been inadvertently ringing someone's mobile phone at 3 a.m. because she got it mixed up with my brother's phone number because he was looking after her at night. And he left a message on, he cracked after, I think, several weeks of this had happened, and he just cracked. And he left a message saying, I better not repeat his language. Is it okay to repeat his language?
Yeah, repeat the language. Yeah, we're post-watershed here. Go ahead.
Okay. He said, you fucking prick, you fucking Jewish prick. I know where you live, and I'm going to come round and twist your head off.
Jesus.
Well, I ended up reporting that to the police, and it got listed as a anti-Semitic incident in Leeds. But thinking about it later, I think he had Googled my mother's phone number, and it had come up that we were Jewish. But I think if he'd Googled it and it had come up that we were Irish, he'd probably have said, you fucking Irish
prick.
You stupid paddy
bastard, yeah, or something like that.
Him awake at 3 a.m.
Fair enough, yeah. I've often said that. You do say the thing that you think hurts most when you've been annoyed. Maybe he wasn't being racist, just stupid. So who are... We know that, I mean, I mentioned today, I work with a couple of Jewish men here in North Manchester. They're well known. They're lovely men. I'm not just saying that because they're Jewish. They are lovely men. And I've asked them if they experienced anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish attitudes. And they've said no. They've said that when people, you know, kick off about the crimes of the State of Israel, they do that because they despise the crimes of the State of Israel. But they never try to blame, you know, the North Manchester Jewish community for that. So I want to ask you, who are the campaign against anti-Semitism and what is the reason? Why are they trying to create a narrative that suggests that Jews are under attack in the UK when Jews are not? Who are they and why are they doing this?
Well, the question of who are they is an interesting question because no one really knows. They organised a rally against anti-Semitism at the end of August 2014. This was soon after Israel's attack on Gaza, Operation Protective Edge, and that's when they emerged. And a lot of the Jewish organizations attended this rally, but there was an interesting blog in the Times of Israel saying, I don't know why the organizations are rushing to attend this rally. We don't know who these people are. No one knows anything about them. And that is the general feeling about them. They kind of emerged from nowhere just after during Operation Protective Edge. I can tell you what I know about them, a kind of potted history of them.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I first encountered them when I went to a meeting held by the Board of Deputies during Operation Protective Edge, because they had held a rally, a solidarity rally in support of Israel, an Israel solidarity rally,
wow.
Can you imagine? And they only got 1,500 people. And years earlier, in 2002, at the time of Operation Defensive Shield, they managed to get 30,000 in Trafalgar Square. So this shows that British Jewish people are no longer prepared to come out in public to support Israeli atrocities. Anyway, they were concerned about this, the Board of Deputies, so they held a meeting. And to our surprise, they invited JFJFP, and we went along to see if we could influence the debate in some way. And we didn't really manage to ask, only one of us managed to ask a question, because the chair of the meeting knew us all and was not going to pick on us to ask questions in case we asked difficult questions. But then we realised that there was actually, they managed to stop the left asking awkward questions, but there was a rebellion from the right. And there were right-wingers, extreme right-wingers, getting up. One got up and said, why are we not being led by the Board of Deputies? And everyone cheered. And then a woman called Mandy Blumenthal got up and said, that she'd been to Bradford, where George Galloway had said it was an Israel-free zone, and she'd gone there and brandished her Israeli passport because she has joint British-Israeli citizenship. And she said she rang up the Board of Deputies to ask for support, and they didn't give her any support. And she got a standing ovation. And the meeting was getting more and more angry against the Board of Deputies and against the Jewish establishment. And they were getting absolutely overwhelmed by this because they didn't expect it. And
Deborah, can I
close the meeting?
Can I jump in there just briefly? Mandy Blumenthal was on Sky News a couple of weekends ago. They did a big report about anti-Semitism. It was typical of Sky. It was completely slanted. Rubbish journalism, really. And Mandy Blumenthal was interviewed briefly in a cafe in London, and she said she was going to leave the country because
of
the...
Oh, yes, I saw that. Yes, I think she's been in the Daily Mirror or the Daily Mail.
So it's amazing that she pops up from place to place. That's very coincidental. And what's interesting about it is the Sky reporter who interviewed Mandy neglected to ask her to let the viewers know what it was that had actually happened to her. It was the most bizarre interview I've ever seen. Mandy said, I'm out of the country, can't live here anymore because of the intolerance towards Jews and because of what happened to me. Now, any basic journalist would say, what happened to you, Mandy? But the journalist didn't. So she's popping up all over the place, Mandy Blumenthal. Smells like a plant, but,
yes,
but I can't prove that.
I'm not sure if she's still, but she was one of the early members of the founders of the CAA, of the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. And she opened the rally against anti-Semitism that they held.
Oh, extraordinary.
Yes. So it was a rebellion by the CAA, and that's when we first became aware of them. And then they held this big rally against anti-Semitism, which I think bears out what Norman Finkelstein says about the new anti-Semitism. Whenever there's an Israeli atrocity that's creating very bad feeling against Israel in the world, and there's pressure on Israel to negotiate and reach a just settlement, there's a tremendous brouhaha about anti-Semitism.
That's really interesting. So we know what happened in Operation Protective Edge. A couple of thousand... More, of course, Palestinians were murdered, hundreds of children. Murder is the only way to describe this. I don't pretend to be objective when we talk about it. It was a massacre. You know this more than I do because you've covered it and you've followed it and you've spoken out on it. And this group pops up around about the time this is going on. That's an extraordinary coincidence. And as you said, because every Jewish man and woman that I know in the country, I've emailed them, I've rung them to say, what do you know about these people, Gideon Falter and these people? And the answer always comes back, we don't know anything about them. And sometimes the answer comes back, they don't represent me, Richie. They don't represent me or any other Jewish man or woman I know. So you think
no,
this
they
group...
Don't. First of all, the establishment was overwhelmed and intimidated. Oh, yes, the Board of Deputies people and the other members of the establishment came to the rally against anti-Semitism, and when the chair of the Board of Deputies spoke, he was booed. Because the whole aim seems to be the Jewish establishment is useless. They say they're a grassroots group. They were a spontaneous, from-the-bottom-up grassroots group. Now, I'm a bit sceptical of that, because they arose at the same time as a whole lot of local Friends of Israel groups.
Yes.
You know, there's Northwest Friends of Israel. Mandy Blumenthal, as well as being a founder member of the CAA, wrote somewhere that she was very active in West Midlands Friends of Israel. And somehow about the same time as the CAA emerged, suddenly, like mushrooms, all these Friends of Israel groups sprouted all over Britain. And there is evidence that they were set up by the Israeli embassy. I'm not saying the CAA. There's no evidence about the CAA, because no one knows anything about their founding. But there is evidence that these local Friends of Israel groups were set up by the Israeli embassy. The lobby program contained evidence, and there had already been evidence in the public realm about it.
You know what we've been covering in recent weeks is the groups in Manchester, or the group, which I don't think has many among its number, but the Northwest Friends of Israel, but also the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. And I can say this without any fear of recrimination or any libel action, because it's true. They've been contacting venues around the country, threatening the venues with loss of business and loss of income if the venues go ahead with the, you know, the Gilad Atzmon concerts or the David Icke talks.
I mean, I don't agree with him. I think he is actually anti-Semitic, but he does have a right to freedom of speech. And the CAA doesn't seem to understand the meaning of freedom of speech. They claim to have scored a great victory recently. Gideon Falter was on Sky News talking about his great victory over the Crown Prosecution Service, because there had been an anti-Semitic rally in Golders Green. And it wasn't in Golders Green. It was meant to be in Golders Green. And then it was moved to Whitehall. I don't know if you heard about the far-right rallies.
Yes, I did, yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, they got so few people. There was one in Stamford Hill. It was organised by about three people. and the one in Stamford Hill, they got, I think, 28 people. The one in Whitehall, they got 20 people. That is the extent, really, of the anti-Semitic threat to British Jews. But Gideon Falter, although he called off, he was organising a counter-demonstration in Golders Green, which no-one actually wanted. The other members of the British, of the Jewish community, had something called Golders Green Together with positive events to counter the hate of the neo-Nazis. But he was organising a big counter-demonstration. But anyway, he called it off, but he went along to the Whitehall demo, and there was a very nasty neo-Nazi there called Jeremy Bedford Turner, who made a very anti-Semitic speech. But everything he said was an expression of opinion. He said in the period that Jews were expelled from Britain, it was Merry England. Well, you know, you can't really put someone in prison for saying England was merry.
No, it's a stupid thing to say.
Without any Jews in it. It's an expression of opinion.
If we locked everybody up for saying something we don't agree with, we'd be in serious trouble.
Well, he even brought up the blood libel cases from the Middle Ages, you know, Hugh of Lincoln. But all you can do is bring up the historical evidence which shows that it never happened, you know. But you don't put him in prison. But anyway, Gideon Falter reported it to the Crown Prosecution Service, and there was a video of the speech which the neo-Nazis put on their website. So he sent the video of the speech, and I watched the video, and it is nasty, but it's all an expression of opinion, and it comes within the boundaries of freedom of speech. But anyway, the Crown Prosecution Service considered the video for 5 months and then decided not to prosecute because they said it's freedom of speech. And Gideon Falter tried to get victims' rights. You know, he said he was a victim.
Yeah.
And they said, you're not a victim. But anyway, he had a 13-month legal battle with them. And then he took them to a judicial review. And I think the day before the judicial review, they caved in. And they didn't say they would prosecute, but they agreed to review their decision not to prosecute.
That's right.
Yes.
Extraordinarily.
Yes. And they're still reviewing it, as far as I know.
I just want to make one point, Deborah. First of all, I wouldn't dream of patronising it, but I love you for what you said about disagreeing with people, but, you know, they should be afforded the right to speak. I love that. I've known Gilad for some years, and he says things that are very close to the bone, and he talks about Jewish identity, the diaspora, and he gets into areas that wind people up, but I don't believe he hates Jews. I really don't believe that.
I think we may have to agree to differ on that.
Oh, yeah, of course, 100%, absolutely. Yes, 100%.
I read his book. Have you read his book, The Wondering Who?
I have, yeah. I liked it. Yeah, I liked it.
I think we have to agree to differ on that. I mean, you know, I don't think it should be banned, but I think it is anti-Semitic. But I don't think anyone should be banned or prosecuted for being anti-Semitic. They have a right to be anti-Semitic. But I also have a right to say that I think they are anti-Semitic.
And you know what?
We have freedom of speech to express our opinion.
And you know what? Because Gilad's been on the programme so many times, if anybody wanted to come on the programme and say, you know, to give their reasons why they disagree with Gilad, they would be given the utmost courtesy and they would be allowed to do that in the interest of balance. So you're absolutely right. You have the right to believe what you want about Gilad, and I don't think any less of you for it. I have great admiration for what your group does and from what you just said there. So these groups have popped up then shortly after or around Operation Protective Edge. They may be controlled by Zionists in Israel. They may not be.
Well, I think that there is absolute evidence that these Friends of Israel groups were set up by the Israeli embassy. There was actually a video. The journalist Ben White, a brilliant British journalist called Ben White, who's very pro-Palestinian, he wrote a book called A Beginner's Guide to Israeli Apartheid. He wrote an article about a meeting he'd been to in which they'd shown a video. I think in his article he had the video. He had the Israeli embassy video in which they had a senior diplomat from the Israeli embassy actually saying that they had set up these groups and thanking people for helping her set them up. Now, you can't actually, I tried to click on the video and it's no longer available. not surprising. But you know, that is evidence that there was a video in which she actually said that. And in the lobby series, remember that lobby series that was shown recently?
Yes, yes.
The undercover reporter is talking to Shai Masot, the Israeli diplomat.
Al Jazeera, that's right. And he's trying to get the careers of senior British politicians ended, effectively.
Yes, yes, yes. That was another thing he was doing. But also, he said to him, he said, I can't give the names of the groups we've set up, but we have helped set up, establish groups in Britain that are favourable to Israel. He said, we've helped these groups to establish. It's good for them to remain independent, but we have helped to establish them.
Deborah, can I ask you this? As well as Norman, people like Cynthia McKinney have come on this programme over the years to talk about the Israeli lobby in DC and how prevalent it is. I have interviewed Galloway on the programme. He's a bit like Marmite George. You either love him or you hate him, but he's been on this programme before. People believe that, a lot of people believe that the Israeli lobby is all pervasive in this country, and it basically, through the Conservative Friends of Israel and the Labour Friends of Israel, it's almost, if not in control, it's almost there. Is that, I mean, some people might say that's anti-Semitic. Do you go along with that?
Well, I think it's a bit extreme to say that they're completely in control, because, I mean, how did Jeremy Corbyn become leader of the Labour Party?
Yes.
You know, they would surely have managed to stop him. I mean, the CAA are definitely trying to attack the Labour Party the whole time. You know, their recent report said over 80% of British Jews believe Labour is too tolerant of anti-Semitism. But the JPR report says that levels of anti-Semitism among the far left are the same as those among the general population. So
they skewed
this whole idea,
the data. Yeah, you're absolutely right. They skewed the data to make it read like something it wasn't. And the Jewish Policy Research has accused the campaign against anti-Semitism of falsifying data. There's no doubt about that. Just a quick recap, because we've got about 10 minutes left. I want to give a quick recap. I'm really glad you came under. I'm glad that Norman connected us, by the way. We've got Deborah Maccabee on the line. Deborah is an executive committee member of Jews for Justice for Palestinians. Go to jfjfp.com. I'll tweet that out there. Nearly 2,000 Jewish men and women in Britain. It's a group that believes in justice for Palestinians. They have a lot of very interesting things to say. Check them out there. How does a group then, like the campaign against Palestinians, it is a campaign against Palestinians, the campaign against anti-Semitism, how does a group like that, which is engaging in some pretty dodgy tactics, like threatening venues with loss of earnings over Gilad, over David and other speakers, how did they get charity status? That's incredible, really.
Yeah, well, no one understands this. No one understands how they've managed to do anything, because they held this rally, and then by January 2015, they were holding meetings with Theresa May, the Home Secretary. They had a meeting in January 2015 with Theresa May, with the Director of Public Prosecutions, and with the head of policing, I think it was. And I mean, later on, they turned against the CPS and the police. But at one time, they were holding meetings with them. And it was so strange. They were just this small grassroots group. And then they suddenly were... They said themselves on their website that we liaise at the highest levels of the country. And Theresa May made a speech in January in which she said, I want to put on record my personal praise for what Gideon is doing. That was when she was still Home Secretary. So I don't think that says very much for her judgment, I must say.
Well, do you know what it does say? You're right. How could a grassroots organisation that gets together and campaigns, you know, online and on Twitter, how can they all of a sudden have access to the highest corridors of power?
No one understands how they did that, really.
Yeah.
And no one understands how they got charity status. And there is a petition, which I think has now got over 3,500 signatories, approaching 4,000, I think, which is asking for their charity status to be stripped from them. The Charity Commission was supposed to be reporting on this, but they still haven't done so.
We
don't quite know what's happening about that.
This is hugely important, Deborah, and if you don't mind, later on you might email me a link to the petition, or is it on the website? Because if it is, I want to start tweeting it out there. I don't want to
We don't have it on our website, but I can send you the link.
Please.
I think if you just Googled Charity Commission, Tony Greenstein, he's an anti-Zionist, a Jewish anti-Zionist. He's the one who started it. So if you just Googled Tony Greenstein Charity Commission. But anyway, I'll send you the link.
That's terrific, Deborah. It's hugely important that, because they're not conducting themselves in any manner that you would associate with any charity.
They are political. They are
a
campaigning political organisation, and British charities are not supposed to be political.
No, and they're representing a foreign power. And do you know what? I just have a couple of quick questions before we do run out of time. And again, I do mean it. I'm so glad that you joined us today. Is there a question to be asked of politicians right across the political spectrum, Lib Dems, Labour? They really shouldn't be members of groups like Friends of Israel groups. So they shouldn't. Their allegiance should be to the people of the UK. And that includes UK Jews, UK Catholics, Church of England. They shouldn't be members of these groups, right?
Yeah, I think there is a question to be asked. I think it is worrying. Yes, and Labour Friends of Israel. Ed Miliband was the first, I think he was the first Labour leader who was not a member. I think he decided not to be a member.
I wonder,
I'm not entirely sure about that, but I think he did decide against it. But Gordon Brown was a member, and Tony Blair was a member. And, of course, in the Conservative Party, they all seem to be members.
Can I ask you a question, Deborah?
It's worrying and needs to be looked into.
Of course it does. Can I ask you a question? Do you think Jeremy Corbyn, now Jeremy's brother Piers is a regular guest on this programme, and I interviewed Piers, and I did ask him some months ago about Ken Livingstone. Did Labour throw Ken Livingstone under a bus a bit? I know that UK Jewish folks, I know they've got very divisive opinions about Red Ken, but do you think that Labour maybe should have stood by Livingstone?
Well, I'm not sure about that, because I don't personally think what he said was anti-Semitic, but I think it was pretty idiotic. And so I can imagine why, I can understand why the Labour leadership was pretty angry with him about it, because it did gratuitously offend the Jewish community, and I don't see any point in doing that.
But what he said was true,
though. People just seem to want to get publicity for themselves and notoriety, and they say things that are not anti-Semitic, but they're gratuitously offensive. And obviously you're going to offend people anyway, but why go out of your way to offend them? So I'm not a great fan of Ken Livingstone.
No, I didn't think you would be. Listen, I can't say I'm a big fan of his either, and that's the truth of it, but I don't think he said anything that was untrue, and I don't think he said anything that Corbyn wouldn't have said, you know, in his backbench days. And, you know, we should have the rights to be offended, but also to offend. So I suppose we'll have to disagree or agree to disagree on that one. Can I ask you this, Deborah? If we don't seriously examine these groups like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and these Zionist Friends of Israel from all over the country, the Northwest, the Midland Zionist Friends of Israel, what are the implications for free speech in this country if we don't do something about it?
Well, it is worrying. I mean, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, I can just give you a latest example, actually, from the Jewish establishment itself. The chief executive of the JLC, the Jewish Leadership Council, did a weekly video blog about the latest CAA report, and apparently he really attacked it. He attacked it very strongly. And Gideon Falter got very angry and said he had to take it down. And he ended up taking it down. But he told the Jewish Chronicle he'd taken it down to avoid community friction. But he said he still stood by everything he had said. And just because he told this to the JC and they reported it, Gideon Falter made another fuss and called on him to resign. Well, I'm glad to report that he hasn't resigned. But The very fact that they could make them take it down. I still haven't seen that blog. I've been trying to find it on the internet, and I can't find it anywhere.
These are interesting times, Deborah, because, you know, again, I want to draw attention to what you said earlier on. You know, people should have the right to speak their minds, even if they are wrong. You know, even if they're demonstrably wrong.
Terribly anti-Semitic. They've got a right to say things. Yes, unless it's an incitement to violence.
And would you go along? Because there will, of course, be some Jewish men and women listening to this, and they will say, there's people in the country, and they ask questions about Nazi Germany, and they ask questions about the Holocaust, and Jews find those questions very offensive. Now, I've interviewed some of these people on the programme before, and I've robustly challenged their ideas. But people say, well, you don't go far enough, Richie. A, they shouldn't be allowed on the air, and B, they should be locked up. What do you think when you hear that sort of talk?
Well, I don't agree, because it turns them into martyrs. I think they should be allowed to express their views. Well, certainly not be locked up. I mean, even Holocaust deniers, I mean, they have a right to express their views, yes.
We've sadly just about run out of time. I want to thank you for coming on the programme. Big shout out to Norm for connecting us, by the way. Jews for Justice for Palestinians, JFJFP, is JFJFP.com, is a terrific website. I've been reading it all day today. Bookmark it and find out more about what they do, what they stand for. Nearly 2,000 Jews in Britain make up Jews for Justice for Palestinians. You know, I believe we have laws against incitement to hatred. Deborah, I believe you are right. If somebody is encouraging harm against Jews or against anybody else, they need to be dealt with in a court of law. Outside of that, we shouldn't be, you know, groups like the CAA should not be allowed to threaten venues with cancelling concerts. That's borderline criminal. In fact, it's blackmail. And I've said before, these venues should report them to the authorities.
I think so. And someone should explain to Gideon Falter the meaning of freedom of speech. He needs to understand that.
Deborah, thanks for coming on. You're welcome back any time. I really appreciate your time this evening. Thank you.
I enjoyed it very much.
It was wonderful to have you on. Thanks a lot. That was the lovely Deborah Maccabee. She's an executive committee member of Jews for Justice for Palestinians. That's JFJFP.com. She's a Jewish lady, very, very educated lady, talking to us on the line from Leeds tonight. No doubt we'll be revisiting this story again in the very near future. Big shout out to Big Norm Finkelstein, my mate in New York, who, when I asked him about covering this, he said, you should get Deborah on. Right, we'll take a break.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalise, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imaginings may be the long-awaited answer. Designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Sign up today. Email Sue on nassusproductions@gmail.com.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
The FDA imprisoned Dr. Wilhelm Reich for his work with orgone energy in the 1950s. They knew he was onto something. At Vibration, our mission is to help raise the planet's vibrational frequency by getting our orgone to as many people as possible. We're offering a free orgone pendant embossed with the flower of life. We just ask a small global shipping and handling fee. To find out more and claim your free pendant, just go to vibration.com/Richie. That's vibration.com/Richie. Thank you.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Welcome back to the program. It's Wednesday, 13th of September, 2017. Great to be with you. It's exactly 4.5 minutes past the hour. We're connecting shortly to Dublin to meet Sandra Fecht. Again, love Sandra. Psychotherapist, counsellor, family counsellor from Canada, is in the UK and Ireland. Got some very serious things to talk about with Sandra. So we'll do that in a couple of minutes' time. Keep the tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter, at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. We are live on davidicke.com. Do bookmark David's website, davidicke.com/headlines. There are details, by the way, at the top of the page about David's forthcoming speaking events in Europe. He's in Maastricht and other places. Go to davidicke.com. And we're live on fabradiointernational.com as well. And please bookmark richieallen.co.uk. Here's some Eric Clapton. When we come back from Eric Clapton, we'll be speaking with Sandra Fecht. Music from Eric Clapton, It's In The Way That You Use It on your Richie Allen Show. 7 minutes past the hour for Wednesday, September 13th. Thanks for joining the programme. Remember, every single programme is podcasted on podomatic.com. Subscribe there if you can't catch it live. And we're also, we archive on YouTube, thanks to Simon Stewart. Every interview we do is individually archived on our YouTube channel. Just go to The Richie Allen Show on YouTube and subscribe to it there. Right, our next guest should be no stranger to you. We were delighted to make her acquaintance about 2 years ago on this programme, despite the very serious and the very disturbing nature of the work that she does. She's been a counsellor and a therapist for over 25 years. She's Canadian. She's very well known and very highly thought of. We first met her, as I mentioned today on social media, after we learned that she was hearing stories of ritual satanic abuse from her patients. She was counselling people, of course, who had suffered trauma and who were victims of sex abuse, but I don't think she was prepared to hear the stories that she was being told at that time. That's how we first met her. Now, she's back in these parts. Well, she's in Dublin this evening, but she's back in the UK and in Ireland for a series of workshops that we will talk about with her and other things as well. Let's welcome back to the programme. She's in a hotel in Dublin, our friend Sandra Fecht. Sandra, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you, Richie. This is very generous of you. And I'm delighted to be here. A little tired. We flew all night, so I'm a little bit tired. And I'm here with my two friends, Fran Tose and Dave Staffen, who are also going to give you their parts of this huge picture.
Well, I'm delighted. And a big shout out to Fran and Dave. I'm connected to Dave on Skype, so a massive hello to them. By the way, I should have said to you, Sandra Tó Fáil Sé Ruait, which is the Gaeilge, which is the Irish language for you're very welcome now that you're in Dublin. And thanks for none of this talk about thanking me. Thank you for coming on after all of this. Well, look, the floor is over to you and Fran and Dave then. What are you in Ireland for? Why are you in the UK? What are you going to do?
Well, my overarching mission, self-imposed mission, is to free the victims of this kind of abuse. And it's probably one in three of us who have been touched by this. And also to help therapists, counselors, healers, nurses, doctors, lawyers, teachers, energy workers, wake up to the fact that this is going on and we are looking at this with closed eyes, the same way we looked at it back at sexual abuse back prior to the 1980s. And the other thing I want to get across is that we can do this and still keep a light heart most of the time. And every once in a while you have to sort of take your hat off and hold it over your heart as you hear some of these stories. But the rest of the time, you've got to be in kind of a good way. And some of the energetic methods that we'll be teaching, if we remember to use them, keep us there. It's a battle right now between creation and destruction. And there are so many destructive forces going on in our world, Richie. I also want to say that we're going to be in London next Friday. That's the 22nd at the London Euston Hotel. And we'll be there with Dr. Rainer Kurtz, whom I believe you know.
Yes.
And Wilfred Wong, Joe Lomax, Fran, myself, Dave, and a retired doctor, retired psychiatrist, Anne Redolfs, who is actually trained as a cult doctor to follow the rules and the bidding of the Satanists within the medical profession. So it's quite an exciting lineup and an exciting story. And we'll be teaching there how to use the methods and help people raise consciousness for themselves. There's lots and lots of hope. We are doing this workshop here at Miles Johnson's Bases workshop, Ireland Awakes. I'm very grateful to be here. And so we have Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday we're doing a workshop here also. So I'm very happy to be spreading the word.
Brilliant. And can I just ask you, just before you go on, is this online now? Are there links to this online that we can mention?
It's on Eventbrite. And if you can't find it, some people have had difficulty finding it on Eventbrite. Apparently, our couple of other events are there. And so you have to scroll down a bit to find it. But it's on Eventbrite and at the September 22nd, 23rd, 24th at the London Euston. So that's where you have to look. And you can come for the Friday night lecture or the weekend workshop.
Brilliant. And if people go to eventbrite.co.uk, if you enter Sandra's name, you are going to find links to where you can get tickets.
Yes, and Trauma to Triumph, I think, is the name of the London conference.
Trauma to Triumph. So just make a note of that, dear listener. If you're in London, I can't recommend highly enough, if this impacts you, and it has impacted you, you need to go and spend some time with Sandra and everybody else that she mentioned. just before, because you're going to introduce Dave and Fran, and we'll do that. I'm going to leave you do that. I'm going to shut up, and you're going to have a conversation with Dave and Fran. But I just want to remind our listeners, it's important that we do this. I know you've been on before, but really, and not to over-dramatise this, nothing kind of prepared you for the stories you began to hear from your patients. That's how this came into your life, really, isn't it, Sandra?
It absolutely is. I just had learned of sexual abuse back in the 80s, and I realized that most of the damage was caused by what they didn't remember. I didn't realize in those days that your brain secretes cortisol to pack the most damaging parts of the memory away, and that the way your unconscious speaks to you is through symptoms. So if you have a resistant to change symptom, like a drug or like an addiction, gambling, drugs, alcohol, some perpetual difficult mood situation, you can't deal sexually, or you have social problems. There are 100 different ways that the symptoms talk to you. But in the end, the symptoms are your best friends. And so I had clients that had these really resistant symptoms. And I thought, you know, I'll learn how to treat this. So I took some programs in NLP, energy work, hypnotherapy, shamanism, and other alternative healing methods. And I started to hear these stories. Now, I was trained in a medical model. And the answer from the medical model is to drug people.
Medicate, yeah.
And yeah, medicate them and put them into a psych ward. And, you know, I'm not a doctor, so I don't medicate, and I had to find other methods. And so I did, and people started to tell me these stories. And at first, with my background and training, I referred them back to their psychiatrist to be medicated, drugged, and put into a psych ward. But finally, I realized, you know, and everybody has to have their own convincers. And from my list of how to be convinced is it scientifically proven? Am I hearing it from a lot of people? Is it part of my own experience? Is it in the Bible? Is it in other cultures? You know, you don't want to do the Semmelweis reflex, which is to condemn without, you know, condemnation without investigation. Semmelweis being a doctor in the 1800s who was basically incarcerated as a madman for suggesting that doctors wash their hands after seeing patients with yellow fever and before delivering babies. And so I would ask your listeners to please keep a very open mind about what we're saying, and to keep balanced and to keep in a good way. We're not saying any of this to frighten anybody, but some of the stories are very horrific, and I'll be sharing those at the workshops. I'm a little uneasy sharing them just on the air, but, you know, basically it's every kind of torture you can imagine. And you know, at least 1 million children a year go missing, according to the stats, and that's without Africa and Asia and most of Europe reporting in. And half of those children are found, but half of them are never seen again.
Never.
And I feel so sad for parents who have been through this, but we as a community need to wake up. You know, we can't do what Dr. Jennifer Frey calls betrayal blindness, where it's more convenient for us to, you know, because of our professional status, or that we might be thought of as being fools, or we're afraid to look at it. We cannot turn a blind eye to this. We have to advocate for the clients and to save the children and recognize this is going on and do something about it.
You made a really good point, Sandra. It's hugely important that we labor the point you made about the medical fraternity. First of all, not believing these men and women. They don't believe him. This is a huge problem. Immediately upon being told stories like this, they are not believed. And as you said, they are medicated, and sometimes they are institutionalized. And this is what we have. I've spoken to probably half a dozen victims over the years who've told horrific stories. And what kept coming back to me was apart from the similarity of the stories, was that they were never believed. I was never believed. I was never believed. I was never believed. And it's hugely important, I suppose, that people like you are there, or that people like you break out of the mainstream to say, well, look, I'm hearing these stories. I believe them to be true. I've investigated them and I've treated people. And if you want to introduce Dave and Fran, and if they want to talk, we are past the watershed here. I suppose we still have to be careful in terms of, you never know who's listening and you mm-hmm. never know how people might be affected. But if they want to talk about their own experiences of this, how they came to be where they are now, you know, in Dublin, preparing to talk to people about these subjects, it's really over to you, Sandra.
Okay, and one thing I would like to say before I introduce Fran is that we are in Ireland today, as I said, and we're going to London next weekend. And there have to be people that have gone through this that are afraid to speak up. I need to hear from you, especially need to hear from you if you've had any reptilian experience. And my email is Sandra, S-A-N-D-R-A, Fecht, F as in Frank, E-C-H, T as in Tom, at Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S, .com. And with that, I'm going to introduce Fran. And Fran and Dave, I will say, are two of the hardest working clients I have ever had in my years and years of practice. If they're given a homework assignment or something to do, they're on it. They really were motivated to get better. They persevered, and the results have just been amazing. I mean, many, many people comment on the physical change in Fran and how she has become younger. She has a keen intelligence and is able to put together and connect ideas. The particular things that Fran and I have been working on and that Fran has documented are the mechanisms of our energy field by Satanism, so that these things limit us. And we have been so turned away from looking at our frequency and energetic parts. And because we don't know it, they're able to do so many things. And I'll point it over to Fran to elucidate.
Brilliant. Hey, Fran, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming on, by the way.
Thank you very much, Richie. It's really nice to meet you in this way.
It is. And again, we're talking about very disturbing things. And, you know, I'm well aware of that. But it is nice to meet you nonetheless. And I'm glad you're in Dublin, Fran. I'm glad you're there with Dave and Sandra. And I think people are going to be glad to hear what you're saying. And I want to just very quickly reiterate, Sandra Fecht, F-E-C-H-T at Rogers.com. If you're in Ireland or in London and you've experience with this, and you need to talk to somebody, Sandra Fecht at Rogers.com, particularly, as Sandra said, if there's been any reptilian angle to this. Fran, tell us about yourself then. And you're in a place where you've got time and there isn't anything that you can't say. So how did you, what happened to you, I suppose?
Okay, Richie. So when I was in grade 7, I was starting to have what I didn't know were memories, but they were of very strange and horrific events that in which I would be semi-conscious or unconscious or in great pain, being tortured, perverted sex, and so on, like very life-threatening situations. And so I had those, what I didn't know were memories, and they just stayed with me my entire life. And I thought, you know, I can't forget this. They never went out of my memory. So I had been doing a lot of social type of work, becoming aware of a lot of the very strange things that go on in the world, like chemtrails and Fukushima and what David Icke talks about and genetically modified organisms. So I was developing a consciousness of, of things that were going on. And someone said I should meet Sandra. And we found that we had a real simpatico in the way we looked at things alternatively. And so I decided to explore these very strange things with her. And it turns out I was bringing her conscious memories of events that had occurred. Now, I would like to say to the listeners that, as Sandra has said, and as you have said, there is a very horrific nature to these things. Darkness really prevails upon us in a heavy-handed way, and they don't respect free will. They're extremely manipulative, and they will use pain and torture and drugs and so on to lower our level of consciousness. But I think a breakthrough that I want to reassure the listeners about came in our therapy sessions when Sandra suggested that we kind of detach from the physical level of things, certainly know what went on, that's important, but begin to look at it in the energetic sense, in the sense that we are all energy bodies far more than we are physical bodies, and look at the events, what was going on at the energetic level, which turns out to be their end game. They want pieces of our soul. They want our energy. They want to limit our consciousness. And they want to put things into our energy field that really make us run poorly. And it's remarkable when you see these things that we call satanic mechanisms. And then through, there was a synergy that happened in timing, me meeting Sandra, and then meeting Dave Staffen, who you will hear from shortly, a real synergy in healing. And thanks to Sandra's really profound level of connection with the universal field of consciousness, the light side, we were given direction about how to heal these energetic mechanisms energetically. And it's really exciting to be able to share this type of information. It's beautiful because the light side is there to support us, but they respect free will so much we have to ask them. They're standing,
Fran,
by in droves.
What happened when your dreadful experiences happened to you? I'm guessing that you were a young girl, you were pre-pubescent young girl, would that be right?
Oh, from infancy onward and probably in the womb as well.
Because I've come to understand from, I'm not a therapist, I'm a lay person. And I was very, very sceptical many years ago about these claims. I'm very honest, in saying that. I used to be very sceptical. But what I've come to understand is the entities working through the people who do, and that's not to excuse the people who commit these atrocities against children, they're after the energy of prepubescent children. And they get that through trauma, is what I've come to understand. And exposing the children to the most unimaginable atrocities. That's what we're talking about here. Am I right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, we're all nodding here. You're absolutely correct. Trauma is one of the ways that they remove energy from the energy field, but trauma also affects the physical body in specific ways that they want to affect as well. So it shuts down certain parts of the body. All parts of the body have functions according to our soul purpose, and they have esoteric meanings. So if, for example, trauma shuts down the corpus callosum, the thing that connects the two hemispheres of the brain. We really need the connection of the two hemispheres in order to connect with God. So they can do this at virtually every level of your energy field, every level of your physical body, and they are masters of it. And we've compiled quite a list of things that they can do that numbers into the hundreds.
Into the hundreds. Now, I'm going to get this out of the way. Sandra will probably be waiting. She's probably been waiting for me to say this. I believe you. I really do believe you. And I used to be incredibly cynical. You know that skeptics, some of them kind, but some of them not kind, but skeptics will say, Fran, how can you be 100% sure that all of the memories or all of the experiences are real? I know you're, I absolutely believe you, but in the interest of, you know, addressing the skeptic, I'm sure you've been asked that question 1,000 times. I know that what happens is real. Have you not?
No.
Well, I'm glad you haven't been asked that question. But you know, people who do listen, because obviously we go out on commercial radio and we're mainstream as much as independent. And people say, these are very, very interesting people. They're very nice people. They're very sincere people, Richie. How can they be sure that they had the experiences? What do you think?
Okay. First of all, I began to have these memories spontaneously on my own. And actually, during the course of therapy, they all came on their own, or let's say a great percentage of them. Before I ever met Sandra, I had them. Next, the nature of the experiences and the traumas is so severe that one cannot keep it in your conscious memory. You simply cannot deal with it.
Yes.
And so it ends up being in the subconscious, but it keeps the subconscious is the driver of your bus. And so your life will show the symptoms of something having gone terribly wrong. And my life is certainly an example of that. As a young person, I showed a great deal of promise. I had an extremely good intellect. I got top marks at school, athlete of the year. Pardon me?
Art and science.
Oh, yes. I was a good artist and really good at science. And yet at one point, I just began to collapse. And I ended up spending decades in a depression so dark that I almost didn't make it out. It's like every second was an eternity of torment. And it was very hard to continue through that. I used to walk into the woods far enough that no one would hear me and scream at the top of my lungs and have no idea why I was doing that. I couldn't make a decision. I couldn't find a direction or focus in my life. The various things show up as symptoms in our lives. And so
this is textbook, by the way. What you're describing is textbook trauma. Symptoms of trauma. It's textbook. I've gone through this myself. I wasn't sexually abused. I was very lucky. I wasn't sexually abused, but I was violently, physically abused badly for many, many years. And everything you've said there brings back, it brings it all back to me. The problems, the acting out, the depression. There's no doubt about it. And for me, Fran, and I want to bring Dave in as well then, and Sandra, they can jump in anytime they want. For me, the things that happened to you, I've heard stories almost word for word similar to what happened to you from people from all over the world that predate the internet, that predate Facebook, that predate social media. Your experiences were real. They definitely happened to you. And what you described there in your later adolescence, in your 20s and 30s, is textbook of severe trauma. There's no doubt about that. I'm not being rude now, but I'm mindful of time, so I want to bring Dave in. Stay where you are as well, Fran, and jump in anytime you want. Dave, welcome to the programme. Thanks for sorting out the technicalities, Dave.
That's not my strong suit.
But you're a good man to have around in a crisis. You sorted it out. So here we are. Well, if you want to introduce yourself to the audience, Dave, and talk about, you know, your own experiences, like Fran, and how you came to be where you are today.
Okay. Well, I'm pleased to be here, and I'm enjoying Ireland, and looking forward to going to England next week. First of all, I'd like to say, for the listeners, you won't realize you've been a victim of the things Fran and I will be talking about. If you have anger that you don't know where it comes from, so much so that you can barely control it, that's a symptom of post-traumatic stress. My adult life, I couldn't fit in socially. I was unable to have a real friend my whole life from childhood up. I was afraid of social situations. I was afraid of confrontations. I considered myself a coward. And I was in 2007, diagnosed with a form of bipolar illness, which with me manifested as mania that I would exhibit at work. And I had this mania for 30 years, for 30 year time period. And upon working with Sandra and uncovering my truth of what had happened to me, those symptoms simply dissipated and were no more. And recently I had a psychiatric assessment done and I was deemed free and clear of any mental illness. So what I'm saying is recalling what happened to me through recovering memories healed my mental illness. The medical establishment doesn't want to hear that or listen to that. So I'm just saying, if you suffer from any of the things I've mentioned, lacks of self-love, self-esteem, self-confidence, dysfunction in all relationships, these are symptoms of post-traumatic stress. So you don't have to have suffered from Satanism to get great benefit from Sandra's healing methods. Sandra's healing methods have allowed me to transform myself from who I thought I was into what I am today. Completely transformed. I'm not angry. I like to talk to people about forgiveness and about the love I've experienced since forgiving, because I had hundreds of perpetrators in my lifetime. I was born into a family whose mother and father were both adhered to the methods, practices, and traditions of Satanism. And it begins very early if you're born into a family like that. Like Fran mentioned, like childhood stuff in the womb. But my memories really started at 2 years old when I would go to the basement of the Anglican church in my hometown and was subjected to these events which were designed to measure the courage, will, compassion, loyalty of their offsprings, because the cult people want to know the attributes of their children. And women were present at these events, and they were a gay old time as they laughed at the little boys fighting each other to see who had courage to deal with animals like rats and snakes and just be challenged in various different ways. And that went on for a period of time until sometime in my third year, the events completely changed. The men often wore robes and were chanting, and now women were no longer present, and events were designed to initiate me into the cult of my mom and dad. And to be initiated into the cult, to become one of them, that was the term that was always used, to become one of them, I had to kill a human being by stabbing him in the heart with a knife, which occurred time and time again. And
Dave, can I stop you there?
Yeah.
You were forced as a very young boy to stab somebody.
Yes. Well, some of my first memories are I was being trained by one of my relatives, now deceased, how to kill small animals with a knife. And they want you to lose your compassion so that you can become one of them. because they live in the energies of hatred. So if you have compassion, you can't live in the energies of hatred.
Did I mishear you there? I thought that you said that you were induced to or compelled to stab a person.
Well, but I wouldn't do it.
You didn't do it.
The invisibles above and all the spiritual beings must have helped me, because I would throw the knife down and yell no, I would immediately start running, because my dad and the other men would chase me, and when they caught me, they would beat me, sodomize me, and mind control program me. And this happened every time I said no, which went on for a couple years, until such time the cult leader declared we must destroy him. If we don't destroy him, someday surely he will destroy us. And so my destruction was absolute, complete, and total. I was beat hundreds of times by older, bigger boys, to unconsciousness, many times per evening, had water thrown on me, beat to unconsciousness again, had kids come up to me when I was walking on the street, older kids I had never seen before, and just start beating me up. And so, because they wanted revenge against the kid who wouldn't become one of them. And they wanted revenge against the boy who yelled at them, I am better than you. I don't hurt people who can't fight back, which I did a few times in my fourth and fifth years.
And children never tell, Dave. What we've learned over the years, even my experiences, I know some people who were sexually abused by members of the clergy in Ireland. We know that children just don't tell. They implicitly think they're never going to be believed. They go into themselves and they don't tell. They don't tell a teacher. They don't tell a friend's mother. They don't tell anybody. They just keep this with them until they begin to suppress it. That's what happens, isn't it?
Well, that can happen. But what happened to me, if you ever Google, like Sandra mentioned, Dr. Jennifer Fried at the University of Oregon, she's made her life's work the study of betrayal trauma, it's called. And that is such that if a caretaker sexually abuses or hurts the child will automatically forget that. It will be deleted from their conscious mind, although it's stored in the subconscious. Because if the child realizes that the people that are supposed to love them hate them and are hurting them, they would lose their will to live and could just die. And there's been... Dr. Fried has studies that show this happened in World War II in England, when the children were moved to the north of England when the bombing was occurring in London and the south of England. And a lot of these babies, though they were cared for, just started dying because they weren't getting the loving nourishment from their caretakers.
Yeah, that's right.
The revenge perpetrated against me lasted for 50 years. I was 53 years old and didn't have a clue that any of this had ever happened to me. And I finally figured out that the anger that was ready to erupt at any moment was the dysfunction, was the cause of the problems in my marriage. So I went to see Sandra and was very dedicated and devoted to find out what the cause of that anger and remove it. And of course, the healing went in a direction I never dreamed possible. And thus began the process of removing all these negative energies, the negative effects from the post-traumatic stress incidents of Satanism from my energy field.
I really want to thank both you. We're not going anywhere, by the way. We've got another 10, maybe even just about 15 minutes left. We're not going anywhere just yet. But I want to thank you and Fran for sharing that. I really do. I mean that sincerely. I know you're in a good place, but it still can't be easy to talk about these things, particularly with strangers, even though that's what you're going to be effectively doing in Dublin and in London, and it's important. Can you and Fran can come back in as well, and Sandra, you jump in anytime you want. These groups of people, which I believe to be operating in cities in England and in Ireland and elsewhere, how did they get away with it? Does it come down to our incredulity? You know, as people, we just were preconditioned not to believe it. Dave is a lovely fella. I work with Dave. I work with Fran. They're lovely. They're harmless. But sure, they're fantasists. They have these fantasies. Is that how these predators operate in society? Because we're preconditioned to think this is crazy. Fran, come back in on that. What do you think?
Well, I think that The main thing, one of the main things is to decrease our level of consciousness. We are amazing energetic beings of infinite potential, and these things they use, the tortures, the traumas, etc., they lower our level of consciousness, and we cannot access who we really are. We can't access the memories. So that's one aspect of it.
If I can jump in there, Richie, there are other ways that this happens. Back in the 1770s in Brussels, a group of bankers got together and decided how they would take over the world. And it's been well documented in a book by William Carr called Pawns in the Game. And what they did was break up families, promote addictions, drugs and alcohol, foment wars. And they said they would foment, you know, that group of obviously generations later, said that they would foment three wars in the 20th century. One was against Russian Tsarism. One was against the political Zionists and Nazis. And the final one would be against the political Zionists and the Muslims. And they're a little bit off target in their timing, but they're certainly doing it. And when you create a war, I mean, think of the amount of trauma that a war produces. And when that happens, if that veteran goes home, has children, the effects of the PTSD of that war are shown up to 10 generations later. So there is hardly a European walking around out there who has not had some aspect of trauma. And when you're dealing with trauma, you don't think properly.
No.
I think the other thing is that many, many people, there's like this dark underbelly to society. And we have judges, lawyers, teachers, ministers, as you well know, priests, just you name it, they're from all walks of life who are part of this system. And I'm thinking of Andrea Sadeg, who has a website called Trauma-Based Mind Control. And she lost her son when she tried to go to court and say, hey, my son's coming, my two-year-old is coming back home after weekends with his father, and reporting, you know, these horrific events that are things that young adults should hardly know about, let alone a two-year-old child or a three-year-old child. And the judge awarded custody to the father, saying that Andrea was mentally ill. And we need judges, honest lawyers who are going to wake up to this. And I think part of the reason we don't see it is because many, many people are involved in covering this up. And it goes to the highest levels of society, just as the Jimmy Savile sex scandal did.
And a number of our listeners have mentioned Savile on Twitter, and Hampstead Heath has come up on Twitter. This is one that I always get criticised for, even though I never said it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. I just pointed out that those who wish to, you know, keep this secret, they will throw things into the public domain sometimes that didn't happen in mm-hmm. order to muddy it. But I never said Hampstead didn't happen. But, you know, a lot of what was claimed to have happened in Hampstead makes sense when you hear Dave and Fran and other survivors. It does. And then when you explain, you know, how this can function in society, how it can operate in society untouched, sometimes on your doorstep, like friends of ours and listeners have been tweeting, you know, it's extraordinary what happened to Dave and Fran, happens to people in their primary schools, happens to people in their own homes, happened Absolutely. In their churches. How could it go on? And that's what the skeptic, you know, keeps coming back with. It couldn't have gone on. It couldn't be going on, Richie. Why do you believe it, Richie? I'm like, well, I believe it because independent men and women have told me for many years from different parts of the world. And, you know, reading David, listening to Sandra Fecht, listening to other people, Jay Parker, speaking to the people in Australia, I know it's happened. I know it's going on. And I know the establishment is doing everything it can to prevent it from coming out, because it might be the end of things, Sandra. I mean, I wonder what you, Dave and Fran, think. If this comes to public attention and the public accept it, it might be game over for those who perpetrate this stuff. What do you think?
Well, I sure hope that happens soon. But one thing I'd like to mention is that, you know, it's regularly reported that there's a $1 billion child pornography industry out there. Pedophilia is the cornerstone of Satanism. So if there's a $1 billion child pornography industry out there, that means there's millions upon millions of pedophiles. Pedophilia is the cornerstone of Satanism. Where do all those pedophiles live? Where are they? They're everywhere. They're interspersed throughout our society on the upper levels and on the lower levels. They're the neighbor next door, they're the guy that waves hi to you every day, and they're the guy that gives you a loaf of bread at the store sometimes. And they're right amongst us. And so that's something to consider when people say it's not happening. The problem the good people have in accepting this is because they can't comprehend that there are other people who have such darkness in their heart. Yes. That they would do these horrific things to children. And that was a big hurdle for me to get over, to imagine that those who were supposed to love me actually did these things to me. And because who would do that? Well, there's quite a few people who do that, unfortunately.
One of the big red flags for me, Fran, was learning that most of the time, sadly, when a woman realizes that her son or daughter is being abused by her husband or partner, and there's physical evidence to support this, and she reports it to the authorities, in many cases, in fact, in most cases, the innocent mother trying to protect her child ends up losing contact with her own child. Now, I know this to be true. It happens all the time. That was a huge red flag for me, that there is something very, 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 very horrible and awful going on, and that it is being covered up. Imagine a situation where a mum realises, you know, baby Keith or baby Mary is being abused by husband or partner, and she ends up losing the child. It's extraordinary.
Well, it's criminally insane to deny the mother the right to the child when she is only trying to protect the child. And it's Sandra speaking here. Fran kind of handed it over to me. So, yeah, there's that. And you asked what it would be like earlier, if I can back up a few steps here, Richie, if, you know, all of this came tumbling down. I would really hope that we would find our North Star, our values again, because part of the agenda of this group from the 1770s in Brussels was to destroy morality. And even, you know, they control the media, they control the music industry, they control everything. And it's hard for people to wrap their head around that. And everybody needs a convincer, something that says, you know what, the penny dropped for me. I realized this. I'm awake to it now, and I see it everywhere. And we, each one of us, have to find that convincer and go through that and start making a revolution within ourselves, to bring ourselves online with morality. And I'm not talking about being prudish or something. I'm talking about being decent, you know, to bring ourselves online with that and to engage the compassion in us again. We're in a society, you know, where these folks did not want to be discovered, so that by the time we all woke up and said, oh my gosh, what's happening, it would be too late. And that is in their own rules. I think of the elderly veteran in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who was giving out plates of food to the poor. And it's illegal to do that in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Madness.
The police approached him, you know, arms outstretched, guns pointed at him, and said, drop the plate. But concurrent with this, they're giving out free books in Dade County, Florida, coloring books that describe all this. It's a free satanic coloring book, yours for the asking. Google it. You know, where the satanic kids are all like cool and thin and pretty, and the Christian kids are all, you know, ugly and stupid and so on. And this is happening, and it's creeping in. And one of the things that they decided to do was replace God with freedom, and then take away the freedom and bring in Lucifer. And you can see it. I mean, if you looked at the CERN opening ceremonies, that was about as overtly satanic as things get, but we are being so accustomed to it now. The water temperature has gone up so gently that we don't even realize we're at the boiling point.
Do you know, we're just about out of time. That's been about the quickest 45 minutes we've ever done on the program. It's just absolutely flown by. You're in Dublin, and you guys are in London from Friday the 22nd, which is a week this Friday. Sandra, please give us the details again of the venues. And it's Eventbrite, by the way, .co.uk for people who want to book to go and see Sandra, Dave, Fran, and many others in London. Give us those details again, Sandra.
We're at the London Euston Premier Inn. And as you have said, it's on Eventbrite. And September 22nd is a Friday, and there's very great speakers that evening. And then the 23rd and 24th, there are workshops in how to recognize and deal with it if you happen to be a victim, or treat it if you happen to be a healer. And it's a fun, believe it or not, we have a lot of laughs. There's a lot of deep work going on, but it's a lot of laughs. And I'm hoping that we can get more and more therapists to come in and start seeing this. Just as there was a revolution in recognizing sexual abuse, I'm looking for the revolution in dealing with this stuff. And this weekend, we are in Dublin at the Talbot Inn in Still, Oregon, and at the Basis Conference, Ireland Awakes. And I have a powerful speech, Richie. I hope you listen in.
Yeah, sounds good. I look forward to seeing the captures on YouTube. I really do. Folks, go to Eventbrite for London, Talbot Inn in Dublin. Turn up on the day, and I'm sure you can pay on the day as well. Huge thanks to you, Fran, and you, Dave, for sharing your experiences with us and with everybody else. I really enjoyed not listening to those experiences, of course, but I enjoyed meeting you. And again, Sandra, huge thanks and respect to you. Folks, Sandra's email address is sandrafecht, that's F-E-C-H-T, at Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S, .com. Contact her particularly, contact her anyway, but if you've got experiences with that are reptilian in nature, she really wants to hear from you. Guys, it was an honour. Continued success to you. Have a great series of workshops in Dublin. It's one of the greatest places you can be in the world, and we look forward to seeing you in London. Thanks so much.
And keep up the great work, Richie. Thank you.
Thank you, Richie.
Thanks, guys. Look after yourselves. Godspeed. Terrific. Sandra Fecht there. Dave Staffan. And we also heard from Fran. They're in Dublin. Go and see them if you can. It's very, very serious and important what they're doing. That just about wraps up this programme. I don't really have time for anything else. Big shout out to... why has my mind gone blank? Yes, of course. Big shout out to Deborah earlier on. Deborah Maccabee, who came on the programme earlier on. The executive committee member of Jews for Justice for Palestinians. Deborah Maccabee joined us. If you missed that, the podcast of the programme will be online very, very soon. And a huge shout out again to Dave, to Fran and to Sandra Fecht there, who are live on the line from Dublin. And thanks to Dave for sorting out the technicalities. The programme will be 3 years old on Friday. I'm not sure what we're going to be doing. I don't know if we'll do anything, but the programme will be 3 years old on Friday. It began on September 15th, 2014 here in Manchester. I've never been one for milestones and anniversaries and birthdays, but there's something a bit special about the fact we're still here. It was a real punt, this programme, back in 2014. The idea was David's, really. I was reticent, to say the least, about doing it, but then I kind of threw caution to the wind and said, you know, well, look, we'll see what will happen. There's a number of very important people whom I will mention one way or the other in the coming days, whose help at the very beginning ensured that the programme survived. Well, survived to this point anyway. Those people know who they are, but I will give them a mention. But it's nice. We'll try and mark it some way or other on Friday. In the meantime, I'll be back with you as usual tomorrow, Thursday, at 7 p.m. UK time. That's tomorrow, Thursday at 7 p.m. Until then, thanks Simon Stewart, thanks Aaron Callan, thanks Jean Ann, and thank you for listening. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday. See you tomorrow. Bye now.
We have on time in the world. Time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more. Every step of